Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Law enforcement training centers have been popping up around the country in the last several years. These are large-scale facilities designed to provide training for law enforcement and other emergency personnel. Proponents see them as providing a valuable service to the communities they serve, better preparing emergency personnel to do their jobs. But there has been opposition in some places, most notably in Atlanta, where the construction of a nearly $110 million police and firefighter training facility has been dubbed Cop City and has sparked national controversy. As it happens, Charlotte is planning its own training center. Last summer, Central Piedmont Community College announced plans to build a $118 million center on 23 acres of land adjacent to their Matthews campus. Mecklenburg County Sheriff Gary McFadden is hoping no one protests this facility, which will be geared toward police, fire, and medic training. And he says this new center will take a different approach in its efforts not to be dubbed a cop city. And to ensure that, he's calling for community involvement now and once the facility opens. With the center scheduled to open in 2027, we thought now would be a good time to take a closer look at law enforcement training centers in general and this one in particular. Annie Keough has written about CPCC's planned facility for Queen City Nerve. She joins us along with Shemaine Cruz, criminal justice reporter at WABE, one of Atlanta's NPR stations, and Brandon Garrett is a professor of law and director of the Wilson Center for Science and Justice at Duke Law. Thank you all for being here. Good morning.
Morning.
And Professor, I'm going to begin with you. There have always been training programs, one hopes, for police and fire and other first responders. But in recent years, there has been, and as we'll discuss, there has been this increased push toward building more of these multi-million dollar training facilities. And I believe that since 2020, they have expanded to 80 facilities in 47 states. Why this push toward these larger training complexes?
Well, one concern is that police officers need training. I teach future lawyers, but training is lifelong. In-service training, ongoing training is really important because policies change and our understanding of how to be effective to protect public safety and protect people's rights changes. And, you know, I think there's a growing understanding that small police academies at small agencies may not be as good as something better resourced and something statewide. There's a real variety state by state in terms of what's required to certify an officer. And there are a lot of small police agencies that really can't provide the level of training that officers need today.
So we're going to talk about some of the pushback to these as we go along. But in places where these facilities have opened and have been operational, how would you describe the result?
It's hard to assess training. I think there's a broad understanding that just giving, you know, textbooks or something like that to police officers isn't enough, that experiential training is really important. Where there's community concern, it is tended to be around, well, what experiences are we training officers for? Are we training them in a way that will cause them to overreact into situations, to not de-escalate, to not protect safety in the best ways? Or are we teaching them the kinds of tactics that we want officers in our community to be using? Second, there's the question of cost. And we are in tight budget times in many jurisdictions around the country. And there's the question, is this the best way to spend resources? I do tend to think that centralized resources for law enforcement in each state, it tends to be a good idea rather than spending money sometimes poorly for smaller police academies that are maybe spread thinner. But the final thing I want to say is, you know, training is no substitute for supervision and policy. It's part of supervision and policy. That's how law enforcement sees it. And so even if officers get excellent experiential education at one of these facilities, they go back to their department, and at the department, the policies, the discipline, the supervision is not adequate, then that training will be a wash. It won't actually help them do productive work in their communities if it's not reinforced by sound regulation at the agency level.
So, Annie Kehoe, you've written about Charlotte's impending facility in the pages of Queen. Well, if there are pages anymore, Queen City Nerve. This is the CPCC campus that I alluded to a moment ago. And these large-scale training facilities have been dubbed in many cases, particularly in Atlanta, as cop cities. Is that how they are referred to by most people or by rank-and-file members of police and other first responder organizations? Or is that more of a derogatory term used by opponents?
Definitely more of a derogatory term. I think it's mainly out of concern for the militarization of police, and opposition typically calls it cop cities. Police, and from my experience, CPCC want to keep to a public safety training facility title.
And where it has been used and meant to be a derogatory term, cop city, why has that term been adopted? Are there instances that they can point to that show you that what they're doing here is militarizing the approach police take on the streets? Is there some empirical evidence that that's what happens when these facilities are operational?
Not yet. There's no empirical evidence, like you said, but there is in the designs, there's going to be an outdoor scenario training or village. And that's from what I have heard, what constitutes the cop city title. Their opposition is worried about police training in a way that would, I don't know, impact the community in a negative way. So they're going into these scenario training villages that are houses, they're, you know, stores, and they're practicing what to do there. And that kind of constitutes the cop city.
It's very much like how the military practices, I suppose, for going into an urban environment to fight. They construct these storefronts and houses, etc., and use them as means of training people how to do that. Chimaine Cruz is with us from WABE in Atlanta. Durham County, North Carolina, also has plans for new law enforcement training facility, which has been met with protests from nearby residents who are concerned about the amount of money being spent and the potential impact of that facility on the community. But Atlanta seems to be the poster boy for opposition. The Atlanta Public Safety Training Center is what it's called. It's, as I understand it, nearing completion and was scheduled to open in the first quarter of this year. Has it opened?
I believe that law enforcement officers and other personnel have started moving in and training there, but I don't believe that it has completely fully opened yet.
And prior to its open, even in the early days of construction, there was a great deal of opposition to this. One death was associated with protests mounted by those opposing this facility, and domestic terrorism charges were brought by law enforcement to others who were involved. What happened to cause this? Did it all occur at once in one big demonstration, or did it unfold over time? What happened?
It definitely developed over time. I started covering this in 2023 when that shooting that you mentioned happened. But there was a proposal in 2017 that this land would be used for a park. And then when protests started happening around policing in 2020 and people started demanding change and things like that, then in 2021, the city proposed this the Atlanta Public Safety Training Center. And at that time, the community wanted to have a say in what that would look like because they wanted the taxpayer money to be used for mental health services, affordable housing, things like that. And so there were also several city council meetings where people would show up and there would be dozens of people show up and speak for hours against this facility. And they felt like the city council just wasn't listening to them and their desires. So then they started camping at the site of the facility, of the future facility. And things escalated. One day, several law enforcement agencies entered the site, and that's when the shooting happened, and more protests followed.
Maybe it was covered in Charlotte. I don't recall hearing about this. This was all news to me when I started reading these stories about what happened down there. They threw Molotov cocktails and fireworks and rocks. 23 were charged with domestic terrorism. And you report this facility was built, as you said, on a piece of land that was intended originally, I think, to be a park, something described in your city as one of the four lungs of Atlanta, in an area that of Atlanta that has been neglected over a period of time. And I think every city in America has areas of the city that have been neglected, and we know how to define that beyond that description. The violent protests happened 2 years ago in, I think, 2023. What has happened since?
Since then, there have been a few more protests, but they haven't gotten to that level, especially because there were, I believe, 23 protesters who were charged with domestic terrorism and racketeering. So that's been, there have been several hearings on that. Another thing is that in the summer of 2023, the city council voted to start funding the facility or for funding the facility. And at that time, organizers launched this referendum campaign where they started going out and collecting signatures from people so that they could have a referendum and the community could vote on whether or not they wanted this facility. And then that summer, at the end of that summer, when they submitted these petitions to the city council or to City Hall, that's when the city appealed a lower court's decision so now they haven't started counting those petitions, and that's just been in limbo.
Will this facility in Atlanta be for just police, or will it be for police, fire, medic, other first responders? And will it just be for the city of Atlanta, or will it be for surrounding areas in your region?
It will be for police, firefighters, and emergency medical responders. And a lot of Metro Atlanta, cities in Metro Atlanta already have their own facilities. I'm thinking of Gwinnett County has its own, but other surrounding cities will also come into Atlanta and use the facility.
And Annie, Concord, the city of Concord, I believe I'm right in saying this, is also planning their own or has their own training facility for law enforcement and for the first responders up there. Is this facility that you've been writing about at CPCC, which is scheduled to start several years from now, is it intended to be strictly for Charlotte-Mecklenburg, or is it intended to be used by other police and fire in other jurisdictions?
So one of the reasons that they're giving for building this is because of a police shortage in all of Mecklenburg County and beyond, kind of. So to my understanding, it's to, help with the shortage, help people get their required training closer to where they are. So it's Mecklenburg County and surrounding counties.
And Professor, you mentioned the idea of these regional training facilities as being a fairly good idea. Is that because it standardizes approach to policing and rescue efforts, et cetera, over a large area? Everybody's on the same page doing it the same way?
Yeah, I would say that it's also a good idea to have larger police agencies and to rethink some of the really small agencies we have in the country. It's just much harder to do professional policing. Most agencies have less than 10 officers. And, larger agencies say, like, we're down a few officers, we've had early retirements, we'd like to improve recruitment. But if you're a small agency and one officer leaves for a bigger agency or retires, it has a big impact. Or if you just have one officer that really hasn't been retrained for the last 10 years. And so these issues become much more pressing for the small agencies.
We have to take a break. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the prospect of a large-scale police, fire, and medic training facility coming to Charlotte on the CPCC Matthews campus in a couple of years, and some of the pushback to these facilities that have been taking place around the country. and also some of the positives of these facilities opening. Annie Kehoe has written about this. She's a staff writer at Queen City Nerve. Charmaine Cruz is with us. She's criminal justice reporter at WABE in Atlanta. They're the NPR station there. And Brandon Garrett is a professor of law and director of the Wilson Center for Science and Justice at Duke University Law. Charmaine, Durham County, North Carolina Sheriff has characterized the use of the term cop city in reference to your city's efforts to put the Atlanta Public Safety Training Center up and running. He's characterized those comments as derogatory, inaccurate, and dangerous. And he says it diverts attention to the need to upgrade his county's training efforts when referring to the Durham County Center they want to build. And I would imagine that police officials in Atlanta agree with those comments. Has the response to these protests, you were talking about city council response, and it sounded kind of vague and not terribly responsive, but let's cut to the chase. What has been the response to these protests? Have they at all responded and changed any of the plans or explained these plans in greater detail in response to the protests they've been getting?
One of the biggest changes that they would made is that they changed where the shooting range is located, because at the beginning there were some complaints that the residents that live in this area would be able to hear the shooting going on while they're training. And so they did change the location of the shooting range. But other than that, there haven't been too many changes. I mean, the city really wants, they did create two groups where people could provide input on how the facility could be used. So they do have, like, there's a trail where people, the community, can come and walk. So they're trying to get people involved in the way this facility would look, but there haven't been too many changes.
There is a lot of distrust, particularly in urban areas, of police. And I'm wondering how they are positioning this facility in Atlanta in terms of public relations. Are they saying that it's going to improve policing, that it will improve relations with the police and the community? What are they saying?
Yeah, I would say both of those things. Something that was mentioned earlier is that there was a shortage of police officers, and in Atlanta that was happening as well. And we have several big events coming here. Like, we've had the Super Bowl, we have the World Cup coming. And so the police chief has been saying, we need better training, we need more officers. And this facility is being used as a way to recruit more officers. For the first time this year, the police chief said that the city has 1,700 officers, which is something that they've been working toward for years now. I'm sorry, could you remind me of your question again?
Just how it's being positioned in the community to allay some of these concerns.
Yeah. One other thing is that the police department specifically was using an old elementary school to do its training, and that building was condemned. So the police chief has said several times, like, how can a city of our size be using this type of facility? Like, we need a bigger facility to do training and de-escalation training.
Brandon, you wrote an article for the Washington Post in 2020. I'll remind you what you said because you probably don't remember. But you said that because adequate data tracking police use of force does not exist, and we've talked about that on this program.
And it still doesn't.
Protesters and lawmakers and others are right to set their sights on structural racism and entrenched police practices. In places where these facilities have opened, have we seen an improvement in those attitudes? Are newer, better practices being taught and implemented, or are those entrenched policies simply being strengthened?
I guess, like I was saying before, even if officers get great experiential training, and experiential training is really important, if they go back to an agency whose policy on use of force is do what's reasonable under the circumstances, because there's no state regulation really, and it's just the constitutional floor, which is pretty low, then the question is, like, what's that training good for? and their concerns that officers are being trained for tactical responses using sophisticated weaponry, but not tactical responses designed to keep communities safer and to, you know, handle people in behavioral health crisis or people who are decompensating, the much more common situations that officers experience in their communities. And so I understand the concern. I think it's good to have police training, and I've said that already, that we need better police training. But to spend millions of dollars in these facilities, if officers aren't being trained on more basic things, like how do you think about diverting people with behavioral health needs? How do you respond to someone who's decompensating? How do you de-escalate situations? What are those tactics?
Explain decompensating.
That's a huge need.
Explain decompensating.
Oh, well, just that, you know, we have many people who are experiencing behavioral health crises at different times, whether it's substance abuse needs and they're addicted and they're coming off of that, or they need other types of psychiatric treatment. And, you know, in some places there have been models, Durham, North Carolina here is one of them, where if police don't have the training to handle, you know, they're not doctors, if they don't have the training on how to handle those situations, you can have specialists who do. And that's why we have a heart program here in Durham that we're proud of. And there's been talk of expanding some of that work in other parts of the state. But if you're in the community and you want to be safer, the question is, what kind of training do we want our officers to have? And what's going to get us the best results? You need policy, and you also need training on specialized topics. But you may not need so many facilities to train officers on weapons-related topics. You may need a lot more facilities in the way of medical collaboration, behavioral health collaboration. And again, it may be that you just don't need officers to do that. You can bring in specialists to do that, like with the HEART program in Durham. But if the community is wondering what to spend money on, maybe it's behavioral health diversion, actually, and not this kind of like warrior mentality training. And that's the concern, that this is warrior mentality training and not public safety training.
And that clearly came up in the protests in Atlanta, or the people working against this in Atlanta. Annie, this all, it may be coincidental, but these facilities have been cropping up a great deal since the George Floyd incident in Minneapolis. And you've already reported on Sheriff Gary McFadden from Mecklenburg County hoping that these protests will not occur here and that people will see this for what he hopes it will be, which is a training facility to improve policing. I'm just curious. He's the sheriff. He runs the jail. What has CMPD, who had their own problems in the aftermath of the George Floyd incident, what have they said about this?
So I didn't get a chance to connect with CMPD specifically about the Levine campus facility, but Sheriff McFadden did say that he and Johnny, or Sheriff, sorry,
Johnny
the
Jennings.
CMPD,
Johnny
yes,
Jennings.
Johnny Jennings, yeah. Thank you, that they were old partners, good friends. So I can only assume that he is going to feel the same way that Sheriff McFadden feels about the facility.
So, Shemaine, Annie reports in one of her stories that Cop City in Atlanta became a focal point for the Stop Cop City movement because Georgia's intense repression against those who oppose it, because of Georgia's intense repression against those who oppose it. Is that how you would describe your state's or your city's response?
I do think that helped escalate or empower or motivate people to come out more and to speak out, because they see this as like one way that, again, police are becoming more militarized, like giving more power to the police department.
And Annie, you said that because of the reaction to George's facility, that played a role in influencing the approach Charlotte is taking to this. How so?
So people have seen the domestic terrorism charges, the police brutality going on in Atlanta against protesters, and they've been worried about their safety, their jobs, their positions as students, and they're worried about speaking up. There was a small protest in December outside of the Levine campus in Matthews, where the facility is going to be. built, and there was a few students from the Pride Alliance at CP and some people from Stop Cop City, Charlotte, and there was about double the amount of security. There were reportedly drones above taking pictures of people's faces. And so for such a small protest that we're following the guidelines of what is in within their rights, people are just worried that they're going to see pushback against their right to protest.
So let's talk specifically about what this Charlotte facility will entail, what it's envisioned to be, what it is going to look like. It's on the campus, the Matthews campus at Central Piedmont Community College. What exactly will it be? How big will it be?
Right now there's planned 38 acres. So there's going to be two different plots, I guess. There's one to the northeast of campus and there's one to like the southwest. So there's going to be a driving range that's going to take up about 14 acres. And the larger facility, which is going to be the main facility, is 24 acres. And that's going to be, there's going to be an indoor firing range. There's going to be the scenario training village. There's a burn tower. There's going to be, there's going to be a couple of ponds, not totally sure what they're for. And there's going to be, spaces for classrooms. And yeah, that's main.
And how does this facility, as it's drawn out, as it's planned at the moment, how does it compare to other police and fire big time facilities that have been opened and operational in other parts of the country?
I think for the amount of talk that our Cop City is getting, I think it's pretty comparable to different states. It's a large plot of land. There's 38 acres in the vicinity of a public community college. I think it's very comparable, yeah.
And there are concerns about our facility from people in that area. What are the primary concerns that people have expressed about this?
People are looking at it from different angles. So there's, generally anti-cop. They don't want to see the militarization of police in their community. There's concerns about the firing range on campus. And there's concerns from an ecological perspective that there's going to be some of the trees are heritage trees, which means that they're a specific size and they've been there for a long time. There's concerns about, the monarch butterfly population. And those are three of the main concerns that I've heard.
Let's start with the firing range, because I think you said it's intended to be indoors. So would that not limit not only the noise, but whatever danger factor there might be from having an outdoor firing range? Have those concerns at all been alleviated by the fact that it's indoors?
No. So from the opposition's point of view, they're coming from a school shooting generation. So people have been trained to be afraid of guns on campus. And the firing range, though it's indoors, though Central Piedmont has said that there's going to be redundant layers of security, that guns are going to be behind a security wall that they have to check out, people are still going to be hearing gunshots on campus. Yeah. And that can be very traumatizing for people.
Some of the ecological concerns are interesting, too, because, as you said, there are these legacy trees. Some of them are 160 years old, estimated to be 160 years old, and many of them will fall as this construction begins on this facility. And you mentioned the monarch butterfly population. Evidently, this is an area that the monarch butterfly enjoys, and we all know that butterflies have been challenged. They are endangered. A lot of their habitat has been eliminated by various different things. Have any solutions to any of these problems been offered?
The main solution that Central Piedmont is trying to give is that they're keeping 20% of the trees on the 24-acre portion, and they're keeping half of the trees on the 14-acre portion. That is still not good enough in the eyes of opposition.
So, Professor Garrett, Annie reports in Queen City Nerve that CPCC President Dr. Candy Dietemeyer has been called on to address some of these concerns, but that so far she has avoided discussing these things in public. Is that a public relations mistake, or is it the smart thing to do, knowing that perhaps any response might simply serve to inflame people?
I mean, I think any time a community is being asked to spend a lot of money on new facilities or programs, it's important for everyone to understand what they're for and what you're getting out of it. I think in general, there's been a longstanding concern that compared to other agencies, law enforcement has often been less transparent about procurement, whether it's paying money for new equipment or rolling out new types of technologies. The community should know if they're using facial recognition or shot spotter gun detection. Like, these technologies should be evaluated, they should be piloted. And so if you're building big new facilities, just like the community to want to know, like, why are we building, a new city hall building? Isn't the old one okay? This is just like that. Any big ticket item, you want community input and you want to get out in front of any concerns. If they can be addressed, good. And if they can't, then there might be more conversation to have.
It sounds in Atlanta, Shemaine, that the response has been less than glorious. How would you explain or describe Atlanta's official response to these protesters and their explanations?
The mayor mostly has described a lot of these protesters as outsiders, because a lot of the protesters, especially the ones who have been charged with domestic terrorism and racketeering, they have come from out of state. So that's been, you mentioned like public relations, that's been his message, that the community actually does want this facility and it's outsiders coming in to oppose it.
We have to take a break. When we come back, I want to talk about how you balance improvements in policing and training with the increasing apparent militarization of police that these facilities can or cannot lead to, and the money that's flowing into police departments around the country. It's Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaOfSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about these large police, fire, and medic training facilities, mostly police facilities that have been cropping up around the country since 2020, and how they impact public safety, the pushback to them, and whether that pushback is justified. Annie Kehoe has written about the one that's coming to Charlotte in 2027 on the Matthews campus at CPCC. She writes, as she's a staff writer for Queen City Nerve. Professor Brandon Garrett is at Duke University Law, where he's the director of Wilson Center for Science and Justice. And Shemaine Cruz is a criminal justice reporter at WABE, the NPR station in Atlanta. They have their own problems with their impending facility, which was scheduled to open in the first quarter of this year. And you report that your facility, Shemaine, is supported by the Atlanta Police Foundation. That's an independent nonprofit aiming to modernize the city's police force and help it improve training and technology. But opponents say this is yet another step toward the greater militarization of policing, which endangers communities. What is the dominant belief about this facility?
I would say that a big problem that opponents have is where it's located, because it's in an area that's majority Black and middle class. It's also in an area that it's unincorporated DeKalb County, so the residents who live around the facility can't vote, like even if that was on the ballot, and they also don't have representation on the city council. So their concern is that you're putting a lot of police, I mean firefighters as well, but a lot of police in this area where this Black community could be targeted.
On the one hand, we are told, Professor, that police are outgunned by criminals on the streets and by gangs on the streets. On the other hand, a lot of folks bemoan the militarization of the police. They do have all this gear now that they never used to have in the United States, and it does appear that many police departments are hardening their operations, their weapons, their vehicles, their equipment, etc., that with things that you would associate with the military. Would police see it that way? And if so, why do they believe it is necessary? Professor Garrett.
Sorry, I couldn't quite hear the question.
Okay, the question is, there's a concern about the increasing militarization of police, and that these facilities might lead to that. Why do police departments, do they see it as increasing militarization, and why do they feel it's necessary?
I mean, I think there's definitely a divide in the professional policing community. Certainly there is a need to sometimes respond with special equipment, and whether it's large-scale protest situations or natural disasters or just responding to first-person shooter-type situations. That said, we've also seen just really flat-footed, dangerous public safety endangering responses. And like, the equipment does not make for a safe police response. Sometimes you need equipment, sometimes you don't. The concern is that some of this training is not well-researched, well-based, or that officers have equipment but not sound training.
Are cities, are police departments doing a good job, a poor job, a mediocre job of balancing the need for greater safety for police officers on the job versus the over-militarization of police? Is there a way to balance that?
I mean, I think there kind of needs to be a multi-pronged approach. There has only in recent years been more of a focus on officer mental health and safety, which is really important, and it has only begun to be an issue, sort of a topic in North Carolina. Police culture is really, really important. We just did a big statewide survey of officer culture at North Carolina agencies. Many officers feel overwhelmed by their work, like many days, and equipment doesn't help with that. Going to a facility like this occasionally may be very helpful to get high level training, but again, you need the ongoing supervision. You need sound policy. If you go back to your agency and they say you have equipment, do what you need to do in the circumstances, then they will forget that training right away because they won't have a culture of reinforcing the training with sound
supervision.
So
it sounds to me like the training is at these facilities is directed at the people on the front lines, the men and women who go out as police officers on the street, in their cars, on their feet, on the beat, and have to deal with the community and the things that they encounter. Are the higher-ups in these facilities, are they involved in specific training as backup for the training that the officers are receiving from your experience and your understanding?
Well, again, states often don't have detailed standards for what training is required. And if officers are going to this kind of training occasionally, it's most of the training that officers get is in service. It's updates that they're getting. And it's also part of how are they supervised? What are they told to do in neighborhoods? How do they respond with what kind of equipment? That's not training. That's what their supervisors are telling them to do and what the priorities are of departments. And so some states have regulated some of that to say, look, like de-escalation should be required. Mental health training for officers should be required. We should deprioritize low-level traffic enforcement and the like, which may create a lot of fines and fees for communities, but isn't super salient for public safety. And so, if communities are not going to regulate police, if states aren't going to regulate police, training is just going to be a sort of a fig leaf, even if it's really good training, and training is important. I'm an educator. It's not a substitute for sound policy and supervision.
So, Annie, you have said, and I've mentioned this earlier, that Mecklenburg County Sheriff Gary McFadden doesn't believe that this will be much of a cop city. At least he hopes that it will not. I was going to ask you how he envisions it, and I'm going to ask you that now. But I'll also ask you, have you heard any of the plans about what that training will include at this new facility, and will it include not only experience of cops on the front line, but the management, the upper officers who don't necessarily have to go out, but do keep a handle on the people on the street?
Yeah, so for the first question, Sheriff McFadden has expressed that he wants community involvement in the training. He wants people to come in as the officers are being trained to see what they can and can't do. He says that it's easier for people to see and then complain with the facts if they have something to complain about. With the higher ups training, it's still in talks. CP has reached out to Sheriff McFadden about what he wants to see. He expressed the community involvement, but as of now, there's been no talks about higher ups. I think it's just
why is he the point? Why is he apparently the point person on this? Why isn't Johnny Jennings, the chief of police in Charlotte-Mecklenburg, why isn't he the point person on this?
Sheriff McFadden has said that he is part of the largest sheriff's department in both the Carolinas. He made it known that his ranking, though people don't see it that way, is higher than Jennings. So he has been the point person, yeah.
So Dr. Garrett, our sheriff has expressed the hope that the public will be involved in this city, in this facility, in a number of ways, including observing, coming in to watch how police are trained. What do you see as the role the public can or should play in these facilities or in the decision-making process surrounding the building and implementation of these facilities? What role should the public, we're not experts at this, but what role should we play?
I do think that the public can play a big role in defining police work and also in police training and just like other aspects of policing, training should be open. I actually worked many years ago on a program where, as part of a training academy, officers were doing community service work with the community. And part of that is like part of what we want to train them to do, to get to know community members, to get to know people working at local organizations and nonprofits, and to talk to them about public safety. I hope that it's not just that members of the public can look through a window and see officers at a firing range. That doesn't seem particularly valuable. But if community priorities are built into how officers are trained, that could be something much more valuable.
Shemaine, in Atlanta, is there a similar call for public observation of what's going on at your facility when it opens and is up and running? And has the public been involved in any way in talks surrounding this facility?
The public has been involved. There was like a stakeholder committee that the mayor helped form. The problem with that was that the city or the mayor chose who would be on the committee. And so people want more of, we're just like regular folks can have a say in how to use the facility. But the police chief has also said that the community will be welcomed. I mean, like Annie mentioned, this facility will have classrooms. So there's been a big push for community policing and just what that will look like. And like I mentioned also, I mean, there's going to be a trail where people can come in and be
So I mentioned, Brandon, that these facilities began cropping up shortly after the George Floyd murder in Minneapolis in 2020. And that could be coincidental, but it doesn't appear to be so because of the fact that these things have been multiplying exponentially across the country. Was that a direct and opposite response to the defund the police chants that arose after the murder of George Floyd, or is it an acknowledgement that police, in fact, do need better training?
I think it did come actually out of a place where we realized we have to invest more in law enforcement, and you know, many states also increased training requirements for police officers. Some states, not North Carolina, you know, introduced new regulations surrounding how police use force, and to say that officers shouldn't be able to use certain extra deadly techniques like chokeholds. Some states also introduced more liability for officers. They got rid of qualified immunity at the state level. So there are lots of different ways that people rethought how we regulate police and the traditional kind of hands-off attitude towards policing. And so there's a surge in legislative activity for about 2 years after 2020. And police agencies understandably were saying, if you want better public safety work from us, we have to improve training. We can't just be doing this at the agency level. I think that was a good thing. Now though, I think there was also an element of large scale, like the largest public protests in American history, and officers were also unprepared and behaved with improper use of force at some of those protests. And so there was a similar concern, like, wait a minute, are police trained well to respond to emergencies? And then, you know, the negative dimension of that is, well, maybe we need to give them more equipment and do more tactical training. But we do want officers to be familiar with tactics. We just want them to also be able to do good public safety oriented work in communities.
There have been several trends since George Floyd's murder in 2020, among them the construction of these facilities. But another thing is that crime statistics, even gun violence, has been on the decline, yes, at least marginally, nationally. Gun violence here in Charlotte has not followed that trend. But is there any evidence that these facilities are responsible for that decrease in violence? No,
it's crime. Definitely a national trend. Nationally, some types of crime went up during the pandemic. Firearms-related crime, DUIs, a lot of dangerous driving, domestic violence. Other crimes went down during the pandemic. Crime had been going down for, you know, a decade and a half nationwide. People aren't exactly sure why. It went up in the 80s and 90s. It went down in the 2000s. It went up again during the pandemic, and now it's going down again. And this is nationwide, big jurisdictions, small jurisdictions. There are some exceptions like Charlotte, but in general, nationwide, this seems to be a trend.
I know I have to let you go because I think you have a class to teach, but before I do that, Gary McFadden hopes that by public coming into this new facility here and observing what's going on, perhaps that might improve trust of police, because you'll have a better understanding of what they go through on the street and the training they receive to handle that. Do you think that's true? Has it proven to be true?
I mean, that doesn't sound like a particularly good, I mean, it's good that they want to be open, but that doesn't sound like any particular substitute for a real community oversight, which we don't have very much of in North Carolina or in most states. Actual civilian oversight of policing with some more teeth, to have a civilian role in investigating claims of police misconduct, to have better data about police misconduct, and to have better community input into deployment of police and public safety priorities. I think that really goes much more to the substance of what kind of policing do we want in our communities. And unlike other government agencies, police have tended to be more walled off from that kind of public input. And hopefully that will change.
Professor Brandon Garrett is director of the Wilson Center for Science and Justice at Duke University Law. Thank you for being with us this morning. I know I have to let you go, but thank you for being here. Annie, we focus primarily in talking about this on police training, but there's another aspect to this facility that we're planning for Charlotte, and that is emergency responders, medic, etc. And this center is proposed to be a workforce development tool and will allow for cross-training among police, fire, and medic with classroom space for mental health and wellness training. How much of this could be done in the absence of this facility being built?
I think a lot of it could be done. There's a big, one of the concerns that I failed to mention was why this is being built on Central Piedmont's land, why it's a college-led project. And I think that a lot of the programs, the mental wellness, the other programs that they're going to enact, it could be in the school or in the community, the county.
And they already teach, I think, don't they? Basic law enforcement and emergency medical science and classroom education for those people at CPCC. Don't they do that already?
Yes.
Okay. Yes. Andy Keough is the staff writer for Queen City Nerve. She's written about this new facility. If you want to read more about it, it's available to you. And Shemaine Cruz is a criminal justice reporter for WABE, the NPR station in Atlanta. Thank you both for the hour.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. We have additional production help from Jesse Steinmetz. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.